We have a very distinguished group of panelists here and a well-stocked group of panelists. So I'm going to go through this very quickly because I think everyone has lots of different perspectives to add to this from clinical side, from industry side, biotech, diagnostics, large pharma, ex-large pharma, so in several cases. So I don't think I need to say anything more than the projections for this space are phenomenal, and I think the best way to reflect how big this could be is to go back to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, space is big, really big, all right? This space is big, really big, and will only get bigger. Ira Mellman's cell cycle, the immunity cycle. Main point, takeaway here, lots of points of intervention, lots of targets, and ultimately, as in oncology historically, but maybe even more specifically here in the case of immuno-oncology, the necessity for combinations to move the needle even further than it has. So whether one believes in the idea of a absolutely non-responsive cancer or not, or we prefer to say less and more responsive, the idea is that we're trying to increasingly, with the various tools as they come online, be able to improve the outcomes in those more responsive and to get those that are less responsive to become more so, and ultimately to keep pushing that bar forward. And clearly, you can go back to historical example on the left. That's from a very early presentation at J.P. Morgan by Medarex in 2007 about the combination data there between anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4. I don't know why that didn't progress, but it didn't. All right, well, in any event, the bars are very hard to see there, but essentially you can see that, you know, as you start these combinations, you start to increase the outcomes. Obviously, there may be additional toxicities to deal with. There certainly will be additional cost, and so determining the value of those combinations and how to bring them forward will be important. Most everyone believes that the anti-PD and other checkpoints will be the foundational component going forward, on top of which many different approaches will be added. And again, we should emphasize that this is not a monolithic space, despite all the noise and the great success and the projections for the checkpoint inhibitors. There are many other approaches that will be necessary, particularly those that hit other arms of the immune system and also are involved in perhaps more directly supplying the antigenic stimulus that's necessary, whether through vaccines, oncolytic virus, and immunogenic cell death, et cetera. Combinations and permutations are the name of the game. I only put in permutations back to my earlier opening slide talk about the order and sequence may very much matter in terms of how you combine these. So it may not just be throwing two things together, but how you put them together and when. And clearly there's a huge amount of industry and academic effort looking at these combinations of all sorts. And this is just look at checkpoints against all sorts of different, you know, standard of care agents, TKIs, radiation, as well as with each other and with co-stims and so on. So the hope would be that one day, this is borrowed from Drew Pardell, one can move that graph up to the top where the survival is prolonged. You have a high percentage of durable remissions, and maybe at the end of the day, as many have hypothesized before in past circumstances, we get to something that's more akin to what you see with HIV, with long-term chronic maintenance or functional cure. I'm not going to go through these. You'll have these slides available. It's just a list of all the activity and major deals in the past several months since this year began, and there's been a huge number in the space across many different approaches, including more recently the BMS deal with Bavarian Nordic and obviously the IDO deals and Rigel deal on TGF-beta, some rehabilitation of some old concepts like vaccines or TGF-beta. So with that, I am going to stop and let each of the panelists in turn give a self-introduction and any opening salvos they'd like to make about the space, both its promise and its challenges, and then we'll get into it. And then anyone who wants to show a slide to emphasize their point, such as you, Harlan, we're certainly welcome to. So, okay? That's for me. Thank you. That was pretty fast, wasn't it? All right. Okay. Go in this order.
All right. Okay. I'm Joanna Joyce. I'm a professor at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the Cancer Biology and Genetics Program. My lab is very much focused on using preclinical models as a way to understand the role of the tumor microenvironment in malignant progression, as well as in response to therapy, and have become increasingly interested in how the microenvironment can be immune suppressive and how we really need to consider targeting immunosuppressive aspects of the tumor microenvironment in combination with immunotherapies in order for T-cell responses to be more effective.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Axel Hus. I'm a leading immuno-oncology at GlaxoSmithKline. We come to the game relatively late. That means this unit is only 3 years old. But we have done a lot of diverse investments trying to get across the entire spectrum of immuno-oncology as it presents itself now. If we think back, the field started in 2011. If we pick a time point, with the approval of ipilimumab, enormous investment has flown into it, and it's become clear that it isn't just checkpoint modulators. Of course, they're very important, but it's not just checkpoint modulators that actually are driving the direction of the field. There are other modalities that you can use to modulate the immune system and increase effects on patient outcome. So now we can actually think about the immuno-oncology space as a place where you can have diverse modalities, diverse pipelines of different agents that can all be used either alone or in combination to make outcomes of patients with cancer better. And that's what we're trying to do at GSK, looking across the spectrum of the modalities that we feel are relevant right now. So we're investing in four different types, from monoclonal antibodies, of course, mostly around checkpoint modulation, to bispecific antibodies, different modalities, different platforms, to small molecules, and then finally, the most complex of all, is cell and gene therapy with TCRs and CARs. So I'll stop there. That's the spectrum. I'm sure all of my colleagues here are involved in one or the other, or many, along that same spectrum.
I'm Jed Walchak, and I'm the Director of Immunotherapy at Memorial Sloan Kettering. I'm just happy to be here today to see all the interest in this field, which many of us have toiled away at for many decades to try to establish it as the next standard approach to cancer therapy, which thankfully it now is. And I'm very enthusiastic and feel that there's great promise in all that's been achieved so far. I agree with Axel completely that the future is ripe for development of combination approaches and also for preclinical and translational study of other pathways. And I can't emphasize enough how much we need to learn from patients who either are refractory or who relapse to the current generation of immunotherapies to inform us as to what needs to be developed next. So sort of the short summary is that I think we've accomplished a lot. The field is finally hitting some milestones, some firm footholds that it's needed for quite some time. And I think we are at a point where we can learn even more.
Thank you. My name is Hai Levitsky. I'm an adjunct professor of oncology and immunology at Johns Hopkins. And I just completed, I guess you could call it a three-year sabbatical at Roche, working there to head up their cancer immunotherapy programs on the Roche side of the Roche-Genentech collaboration. It was a fantastic experience, I think really hitting at a time where the ability to place some well-calculated bets as well as developing internal programs really provided the opportunity to generate portfolios that populate the cancer cell cycle, immunity cycle that was shown at the beginning of the talks. And now the challenge upon us is to figure out how to use these together. And I think maybe the one comment I would make in keeping with the theme of the meeting and in particular following the session on pediatrics and rare diseases is that even for quote-unquote more common adult malignancies, we're facing the same problem. And by that I mean that we really need to be able to make informed decisions on very small numbers of patients, not only because of the permutation and combination challenge that was highlighted at the beginning, but also because of the fact that we now appreciate that response rates really do not do justice to the full benefit that may be achieved by immunotherapy, and yet survival studies, by their very nature, are long and challenging. So we have many of the same challenges, I would argue, as were highlighted in the previous session, about how to identify, hopefully, biomarker-driven assessments of the right combinations and approaches short of the larger studies that have historically been mandated for drug approval or even therapeutic development.
because I was going to do slides, but I think that would be the odd man out here, so I'll just talk. So I'm Harlan Robbins. I'm a professor at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle and the University of Washington, and the founder and chief scientific officer of a company called Adaptive Biotechnologies. We're a 160-person company in Seattle, headquartered in Seattle anyways. And you heard a lot this morning about biomarkers. In particular, you heard a lot about looking at the cancer genomes. But since, you know, there's a new, the new area of therapy, immunotherapy, is actually targeting the immune system more than the cancer. And so we need a new class of biomarkers to be able to assess that. And that's what we do. We sequence T-cell and B-cell receptors at high throughput. And in particular, we're looking at tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes to predict who will and won't respond to therapy. We also look in the blood to see we're doing actually quite a good job of seeing early the side effects from these immunotherapeutic agents. You know, we spend, I think the important part, you have to define what a healthy immune response looks like and develop, thousands and thousands of patient samples where we can assess healthy and then the disease state and see if these immunotherapies are causing at early states when intervention is still possible with different steroids, whether we can assess that. I think we'll get into it a little bit more in a minute, but pass it on to
you. Do you want to advance the slide for you?
Oh, it's okay. No, it's okay. I'm going to... Right. Oh, yeah, we can... You can go on a little bit, I guess. Keep going. And one more. And so, you know, this is a paper we published with Tony Rebus's group at UCLA looking at Merck's anti-PD-1 drug looking at as applied to melanoma. And we just asked if the expanded... So we have a very simple hypothesis, right, which is I think it's been proven out in some of Jed's work as well as a bunch of other groups, which is that you need a T-cell response inside of these tumors for the checkpoint inhibitors. The checkpoints are shutting off these tumor responses, and if they're not shutting off these... and if the tumor response isn't already there to be shut off, then it's the equivalent of having a car with no gas. If you release the brake, if you don't have any gas, you're not going to go anywhere. It's the same statement. If you don't have a tumor response, a T-cell response ready to go when you remove the checkpoint, then you're not going to attack the tumor. And so what we did is we just simply evaluated by sequencing. We just looked at if there's a clonal T-cell response inside the tumor. If you have a clonal T-cell response, that's the classic sign of having an immune response. If you don't have one, then you don't have an immune response going on. And we just asked, do we have a predictive biomarker of response to this anti-PD-1 drug? And the answer was kind of an overwhelming yes. All the green, so clonality, whether there's a clonal T-cell response is plotted on the x-axis. All the green dots are the responders, and the red dots are the non-responders. So as you can see, the green dots are primarily on the right and the red dots on the left, meaning that if you're clonal, you have a T-cell response ready to go, you respond to anti-PD-1. And this was published in Nature in December. And so I think we can pick out the subset of patients who aren't going to respond to these drugs. The nice thing is this is not hopeless. There's all sorts of other agents can you go to the next slide? There's all sorts of agents that can create an immune response, and then you can hit them with, say, an anti-PD-1. This is what BRAF is, something that I don't think anybody expected to do this, but we showed in a study from Jen Wargo's group that it does just that. It creates an immune response. It looks like it creates a clonal expansion of T cells inside the tumor. And we've seen this with many, many drugs as well as different procedures, radiation, et cetera. So there's lots of ways to go after to kind of combine these drugs to create effective response. Okay, now I'm really done.
All right.
Thanks, Harlan. My name is Ada Brown. I'm Chief Medical Officer at Biosera. I'm a relatively recent addition to the immuno-oncology field. Biosera, however, is not. They've been working since 1997 in the innate immunotherapy arena, which clearly is an outlier, just looking at this panel and the room. the way they are harnessing the innate immune system is by virtue of complex carbohydrate technology that was initially developed at MIT and then acquired by Biothera. It consists of beta-1,3,1,6 glucans that bind to complement receptors and Fc-gamma receptor 2, among others, and as such activate innate immune cells, neutrophils, monocytes, macrophages, within others, to be able to recognize and kill complement-opsonized tumor cells. So this technology is unique in that it's meant to be co-administered with therapeutic complement-activating antibodies such as rituximab, trastuzumab, etc. And more recent research has also shown that there is certainly a change in secretory pattern of these activated macrophages, and by that a change in the immune microenvironment. So we see interferon gamma production and certainly PD-L1, PD-1 upregulation. And so with that, now there is a whole new avenue that builds on Drew Padal's initial hypothesis of stimulating adaptive immune resistance, upregulating PD-L1, and then targeting that environment with a PD-1 or PD-L1 targeted agent. So we have multiple combination strategies that we're actively pursuing in combination and in collaboration also with cooperative groups and investigators in the clinic. Our most recent data really has been a little bit of a coming of age of innate immunotherapies, stem from a randomized phase 2 study in non-small cell lung cancer in combination with a VEGF-targeted antibody that has been shown to induce complement, bevacizumab, where we've seen quite astonishing survival benefits of a hazard ratio of 0.6 that will need to be confirmed in a phase 3 setting. So we're right now at a turning point to expand and accelerate the clinical program of innate immune modulation.
Thank you, Ida. And of course, fortunately, last and not at all, is Nils Ungberg from BMS. So just to make a few opening comments, self-introduce yourself, and since you're at the forefront of the field here.
I'm Nils Lundberg from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and as I said this morning, Bristol-Myers Squibb is not forgetting about biomarkers. What else can I say? I'll pass the microphone off.
All right. Well, that was a good intro. All right. So let's take this. We'll get to biomarkers. But I want to take it first from this issue of combinations, because I think that is one of the big issues here. You saw my slide earlier in terms of just the sheer number of combination trials that are going on. And I also want to start here because of the interesting slide that Harlan showed, because I think it's easy to get caught up in, you know, which checkpoints do we combine with co-stims, with vaccines, et cetera, and to forget about the continued value of whether it's apoptotic, necrotic, other types of cell death from radiation or cytotoxic chemotherapy, let alone the whole world of kind of targeted agents, standard of care, that have many interesting activities that, you know, were never really realized in their immune context because they weren't studied in models for which those were active. So let's start with the two, I think, industry players, or industry and ex-industry, after your sabbatical having finished, to just get some perspective in terms of thinking about this challenge of clinical trials, because clearly there's a huge number of agents, so the kind of the bottom-up mechanistic point of view driving those, the kind of the top-down strategic view of looking for those combinations, as well as implications to the type of deals that maybe are, that we're seeing. So, Axel, you want to go, and then hi?
Yeah. We actually have three industry players, just to say it. But in any case, from a scientific perspective, combinations offer a lot of opportunity. And if you think back in the way we have approached combination therapy in oncology, which is not a foreign concept at all, historically we combine things on the basis of mostly what makes sense in the development space. So which areas are underserved, what standards of care exist, how can we get a new agent in the context of existing standards of care? That has often led, especially in the context of marginal improvements over existing therapies, to a variety of combinations. They were often not really scientifically driven. Now, if you think about it today, in the immuno-oncology context, we have an opportunity with a plethora of different agents to actually do this on the basis of science and then see where we can place them also in the context of standard of care. And I think I see some of that happening. There's a lot of activity in the space trying to form partnerships between different organizations to get agents investigated in combination. It's more partnerships than I've ever seen in oncology at any other point in time. I think it's a very positive development, and it should lead to progress much faster. And it actually has somewhat led to a race, I would almost say. Whoever combines something first and enters a new space might occupy that space for a certain period of time. Now, having said that, the science piece should not come too short in this. So I give you an example from my own experience. The BRAF and MEK inhibitors, the dabrafenib and trametinib, which GSK has developed, and then which are very recently sold to Novartis, we have expected that in the melanoma space where those two drugs have been approved, that we would need to find ways of combining them with the immunotherapies that have entered this space and have very successfully improved on patient survival. So understanding the science behind such combinations is as important as the sheer idea of combining standards of care. So we started with characterizing the dabrafenib and trametinib effects on the immune system. Since these drugs were not designed to treat the immune system or have immunological effects, but they're given systemically, it was logical to expect that there might be immunological effects. And we have identified those, and it's been done also for other targeted therapies in this area. And we used the lessons to design our phase one and two trials to actually get the combination into people. These trials are running right now, and they look very promising. Obviously, there is no real good data yet to talk about efficacy, but the one thing we have learned is that, of course, when you do new combinations, you always have to worry about safety. So we've seen some safety signals that needed to be navigated and that preclude you from taking certain directions in further development. Another thing we have learned is that sequencing might matter, since there is not only a plethora of different combinations possible, there's also a plethora of different sequences of those combinations possible. And what works best, what gives the most patient benefit, is still to be explored. So we use preclinical models to start trying to filter this, because you can't do it all in people. And we can see in some instances that sequencing events, that means starting with a targeted therapy for a certain lead-in period, destroy some tumor, release antigen, stimulate an immune response, and then follow that up with the checkpoint modulator, seems to make sense. At least preclinically, that does better than it is with concomitant administration from day one. So these are interesting observations and lessons that we can leverage in the clinic. So what will happen in the clinic in the long run is still to be seen, but there are so many opportunities right now that a systematic approach to combinations is necessary, a scientific and systematic approach. And I think the field is taking that, not just individual companies, but the entire field is going in that direction.
Let's hear from Nils now, because the sheer effort being placed by BMS on the number of trials and combinations is quite staggering. So
I think that there's an alarmist view when you look at the number of possible combinations and the length of time it would take and the resources it would take to test all those combinations. But I disagree with that alarmist view. Right now, the PD-1 pathway appears to be a relatively fundamental pathway of attenuation that has to be overcome. And PD-1 pathway blockade is relatively well tolerated in the clinic. And when you combine those two sets of facts, it is natural to assume that you're going to want to use PD-1 as the backbone for combinations. And that really simplifies the math. You're just combining things one at a time with PD-1 blockade. It's going to get obviously more complicated at some point in the future when we start talking about triple combinations. But right now, it's not that daunting. And Axel is right. You have to be led by the science, and I think we're being led by the science. PD-1 and CTLA-4 blockade and the combination of those two worked well in animal models, so I would argue that mouse syngeneic models got us where we are right now.
We don't know if they're going to continue to be successful. The one thing where I differ, I think, slightly with Axel is I don't think sequencing is easy to work out in the animal models. The tumors grow too rapidly in the animal models, and particularly when you're talking about antibodies, the half-life of the antibodies makes it very difficult to work out sequencing in those models. I think when you throw sequencing in, it really throws in a very large number of variables that makes it almost impossible to explore the whole space. And we're really best off right now looking at the combinations as combinations rather than as sequenced events.
And then, Hi, if you can comment, then I'd like Jed, you to kind of chime in with the kind of the real-world
sure.
experience.
So I'll try to be brief. Just to put a little historical context in this, when I first joined Roche 3 years ago, I put a sign up in my office that said, the combination is the drug. And the message that I was trying to get across is that really in thinking about development of cancer immunotherapies, it's really about hitting the pathways in ways that looks for synergy. This was, to my surprise, a bit of a mind change for most of the people who had cut their teeth in drug development and oncology, where it was get a drug, understand how it works, show clinical activity, and then begin to look at combinations. We were actually proposing, and now I think it's become even fashionable, you know, to develop clinical development plans where you may not see or even expect to see single agent activity of either new molecular entity alone. We'd like to see it, but we don't believe that that's necessarily a requirement if you have a clean enough set of parameters that you can measure. It's great to see that the field has moved. I think now more and more of the trials in so-called phase 1Bs are putting together two NMEs in ways that probably wouldn't have been considered appropriate before. And I think we're learning an enormous amount in doing so. I don't think any of the speakers before me have commented on the other part of the elephant in the room, and that is, of course, synergistic toxicities, which have been experienced with several of the combinations, and particularly, I think, as we move toward putting together immune agonists together with checkpoint inhibitors, may see more of. I might differ a little bit from Nils' comment about sequence. I think sequence does provide at least one additional way of manipulating the potential synergistic toxicities without losing synergistic activity. That remains to be proven, but I think at least early experiments in that space suggest that this is something that will need to be looked at, although I do agree that adding the variable of time is just one more dimension to the challenge that's before us. And I guess the last thing I'll say is to reiterate what I'd commented on earlier about what's the readout. And you know, we are all deeply enamored, of course, when we see radiographically measurable responses, and for sure those are important and correlate with clear clinical benefit in most cases, but they don't encompass the totality of the benefit or even approximate the totality of the benefit. And so I would advocate for continued efforts to identify, you know, those changes in the tumor microenvironment and in the host response that really are what we're striving to elicit with the combinations to have a more rapid and hopefully more robust appreciation of what works and what doesn't.
So I think from the standpoint of someone who is evaluating these combinations, whether they be immunotherapies with other immunotherapies or immunotherapies with targeted therapies or other anti-cancer treatments, many of the statements that the other panel members have made ring true. In fact, the science really drove the combination of CTLA-4 with PD-1 blockade, and the science actually drove some of the observations that Axel referred to with the immune modulating effects of targeted therapy. So I think that that's going to be a consistent theme, that the preclinical mechanistic science is going to bring forth the possibilities that need to be formally evaluated in the clinic, because that is really, and I'm not speaking any, you know, great truths here, but that's really where the most important data is going to come from. And some of the observations that, you know, have been referred to regarding toxicity, you know, were a little bit unpredicted based upon the preclinical models. And this is really referring a lot to targeted therapy, immunotherapy combinations. And I don't think that they represent stumbling blocks. I think they represent opportunities to be more creative about the way those combinations are put together in people. But, you know, I think that it's important to realize that the science will drive us toward a rational understanding of what to bring into the clinic. So Nils is correct that this is not alarmist. It's not unlimited permutations and combinations, that there really is a finite collection of things that that are going to be tested. I think that we need to be able to iterate based upon what we see on the ground in the clinic. And we need to be able to adapt to the observations that have been made by being flexible in clinical trial design. I think we've shown ourselves able to do that. And one paradigm which I'll throw out there as being potentially a topic for additional conversation is the end of the one-size-fits-all approach for at least combination therapies in this disease, meaning that, you know, I think when we look, for example, at the combination of CTLA-4 and PD-1 blockade, the dose that is optimal for one group of patients who are labeled with one particular diagnosis may not be the best for a different group of patients. We need to recognize that different cancers may have a different ability to immune suppress the host, and therefore the pharmacologic window that you operate in that patient population may be different than another patient population. And so we have more fine-tuning to do with combinations that we do with monotherapies, but that doesn't mean that combinations are out in one disease just because the toxicity profile may not be what we expect based upon data from a different disease setting.
Let me pick up on two comments, one that Hai made about, you know, microenvironment and what Jed just said about, you know, the immunosuppressive environment. Now is a chance to bring in both Johanna and Ada. So clearly there's been a lot of focus and continues to be in development and clinical trial activity, et cetera, around targeting T cells, whether checkpoint inhibitors or co-stims. But there are many other targets and arms in the immune system, as well as other cell types that are involved or co-opted and become part of that immunosuppressive tumor microenvironment. So maybe start with you, Johanna, to talk a little bit about what some of those other targets are and their relevance or interaction with, you know, some of these leading edge targets that we have right now, such as CTLA-4 and PD-L1.
Yeah, I mean, I think with regards to the tumor microenvironment, something that's already been brought up, and maybe people are thinking in the context of clonality of T cells, but if T cells don't have access to the tumor bed, by definition, they're not going to be able to attack the tumor. And the microenvironment, there's a number of different mechanisms by which a whole plethora of cells within the tumor microenvironment can regulate the entry of T cells into the tumor, regulate the expansion of T cells within the tumor, regulate their function, regulate their viability, and the cells that are involved in these different functions include the vasculature. So just at the level of whether T cells can gain access to the tumor or not, the vasculature has a very potent role in allowing some types of immune cells, such as myeloid cells and regulatory T cells, access to the tumor, but through directed apoptosis against T cells prevents those cells from gaining access. So it's been proposed and certainly shown in preclinical models that strategies that have been around for a long time now, anti-angiogenic therapies, could in fact be reutilized if we're able to achieve vascular normalization to improve T cell delivery into the tumor. And it's been shown in those cases, again in preclinical models, where normalization has been achieved, that enhances the efficacy of T cell therapies, including adoptive cell therapy. So that's one potential avenue where a combination of therapies that already exist could be envisaged and is being envisaged by a number of different companies. Other approaches include targeting so-called myeloid suppressor cells, so myeloid-derived suppressor cells, tumor-associated macrophages. Again, these cells have very potent functions in terms of suppressing the function and also accumulation of T cells, and has been shown in preclinical models, inhibition of pathways controlling either the number or the polarization of those cells, for example, CSF1 receptor inhibition, can lead to an unleashing of T-cell response, perhaps indirectly. And then there are also examples of where targeting immunosuppressive enzymes, for example, indole-2,3-deoxygenase, or IDO, produced by tumor cells, but also produced actually at very high levels by myeloid cells, is another means to relieve that suppression against the T-cells. And finally, cancer-associated fibroblasts can physically exclude T-cells from the tumor microenvironment. So what we call the stroma in the tumor microenvironment that often has this kind of catch-all term, and many people don't really know what this means, but if we have it in the most kind of classical sense, the extracellular matrix that is produced and laid down by cancer-associated fibroblasts, often at the periphery of tumors, can physically exclude T-cells from entering into the tumor microenvironment. So physically interfering with the composition of that extracellular matrix, physically interfering with cancer-associated fibroblasts, targeting those cells specifically, can again relieve that suppression and allow T cells entry into the tumor microenvironment. So I think the take-home message here is that there's, in many cases, a very potent immunosuppression, a number of different mechanisms by which that can be achieved, but also a number of different nodes that we could therapeutically target to relieve that immunosuppression and allow T cells access to the tumor where they obviously have their cytotoxic effects.
And then, of course, aside from that tumor microenvironment and affecting the T cells and other aspects of the adaptive immune system, there is the innate immune system. So maybe just comment a little about ADA, and then obviously BMS also has anti-KIR antibody through their relationship with innate. So.
Sure. So, first of all, that was a very eloquent overview of, macrophages and other cells and in the microenvironment. Thanks, Johanna, for that. Certainly, targeting macrophages, which is, what glucans do with another, is a very rational strategy by virtue of what's just been explained, and given that macrophages are, in many solid tumor types, at least the most abundant immune cell type present through all stages of tumor promotion and progression. And so certainly there is an enabling effect of macrophages that was referred to. But we also know there is a tremendous challenge in targeting these cells given their plasticity. We know that these cells can be tumor promoting as depending again, on their polarization. And so making sure that there is the right polarization of macrophages from a tumor-induced promoting phenotype, or what we call an M2 phenotype to an M1 phenotype, is certainly necessary. And these cells will then act to further shape their microenvironment. And so therapeutically achieving that, I think, is something that perhaps is a little underappreciated right now. So in terms of innate immune activating therapies, obviously there is tremendous overlap as well, given expression of some of the antigens, both by macrophages as well as adaptive immune cells. So, for example, LAG-3 and others. But then again, toll-like receptors and other strategies may be more directed towards the innate immune system. And pursuing that, as well as combination approaches with adaptive immune therapies, I think hold tremendous promise. One thing that was touched upon in the very early session today is also the fact that there are dramatic responses and long-term benefits with checkpoint inhibition, but there are there was only a subset of patients that appeared to be benefiting. Clearly, we need to understand that subset better. But again, if we can induce adaptive immune resistance markers, maybe in a sequential therapeutic administration approach, I think that also can help hold tremendous promise. And again, macrophages being secretory active, having certainly the potential to shape the tumor immune microenvironment by a release of substances like IL-10 or conversely interferons, holds tremendous promise.
So then to pick up on the comment that Jed made about not having one size fits all, and you just alluded to it now, Ada, I'd just like to hear both from Harlan and from you, Nils, about, you know, a little more about kind of where we're at and where we need to go in terms of trying to stratify or otherwise kind of segment patients for the most appropriate, whether it's, you know, single agent with a anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 or, you know, somewhat more complex combination approaches. So,
I mean, the going first back to the whole issue of the role of macrophages in the tumor microenvironment, it's probably going to be very different from tumor to tumor, not just tumor types, but also individuals. At least within melanoma, checkpoint inhibitors appear to be very active. So you look at CTLA-4 blockade alone, and yes, there's a lot of patients who don't benefit. You look at PD-1 blockade alone, there's a lot of patients who don't benefit. But when you combine the two, there's not a lot of patients who don't appear to benefit, at least in the clinical trials that Jed has done. So it doesn't look in that particular histology like there is a significant blockade from, you know, macrophages or other cell types that are blocking the immune response. Jed, do you want to comment?
I think that's true. I think it also highlights another level of complexity that exists, that there are a lot of diseases that are rolled into the term melanoma, just as an example. And we're now learning that there are differences within subtypes of melanoma, largely driven by changes in genomics, number of mutations that are present at baseline, not in necessarily in oncogenic drivers, but also in the so-called passenger mutations that could, in fact, have a profound influence on the likelihood of outcome from immunotherapy. And I think that was a very important step forward in our understanding of why some patients benefit from immunotherapy and why many patients, for example, with cutaneous melanoma tend to benefit from checkpoint blockade, because this is a disease that is relatively abundant in passenger mutations, as are tobacco-related cancers like non-small cell lung cancer. As we dig a little deeper, we may find pockets of patients within categories that were considered non-responding to immunotherapy, like colorectal cancer, where there are small subsets of patients who have favorable genomics in their tumor that make them exquisitely sensitive to this type of approach. So I think that in addition to expanding our appreciation of differing doses and perhaps differing schedules of these medicines across diseases, even within diseases, we may need to think much more creatively than a certain disease defined by how it looks morphologically under the microscope is amenable to a certain type of therapy, that this idea of precision medicine is something that is, you know, obviously critically important when it comes to targeted pathway inhibitors, but I think it's rapidly emerging as being important in the era of immunotherapy as well.
And so just a brief comment on the macrophages. I think that for the first time, really, in the history of cancer immunotherapy, we have a tool, which is that we have within a given disease type responders and non-responders that we can compare over time the changes in tumor. And one of the places where this has been looked at is in metastatic bladder cancer patients treated with anti-PD-L1, and it's now in the public domain. It's been presented that, you know, both gene expression profiling as well as fairly crude immunohistochemical analysis suggests that either the presence or signature of certain macrophage phenotypes is powerfully associated with a lack of response to anti-PD-L1 in those patients. Now, whether or not now modifying that, such as with an anti-CSF1R antibody, which is currently in the clinic, will change that outcome is a hypothesis that needs to be tested. But I do think that there's a growing, you know, level of evidence that these cells are at least correlated with the differential response rate, and whether that can be manipulated, we'll soon find out.
But over and over again, we keep hearing the same refrain, a plausible hypothesis that needs to be tested in the clinic. All of these things need to be tested in the clinic.
Absolutely.
Harlan, chance to chime in now.
Yeah, so just picking up where Jed left off, I think the picture is starting to come together a little bit. I mean, the Memorial Sloan Kettering group, a lot of it led by Jed, is really shown that the amount of mutations, the mutational status of your tumor is predictive of who will and won't respond to, say, an anti-PD-1. And, you know, there's a bunch of other groups doing other biomarkers that I think are looking at, in a different way, at almost the same thing. Like, we're looking at clonal responses in a tumor, T cell expansions, which, you know, it's just, if you have more mutations, that then you have more targets for the adaptive immune system, you're more likely to get a response, and therefore all these things go hand in hand. But the point is that you know, we have these biomarkers now to pick out the patients that have those immune responses, whether it's a correlate by looking at number of mutational status, or whether it's just looking directly at who's engaging in immune response at that particular time. And, you know, these drugs do very different things, anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4. I think we heard a lot about what they do in terms of what pathways they hit, et cetera. But just from my perspective, where we're looking downstream of that and just seeing what the effect is, if you have a anti-CTLA-4 will cause clonal expansions in the case where you have more and more T cells in the tumor. So how many T cells in your tumor is going to correlate very strongly with response for anti-CTLA-4. So you can do things like there was a paper that came out by Bob Vanderheide's group at Penn just the other day that just said if you radiate tumors and then hit it with one of these anti-CTLA-4 or anti-PD-1, you get this massive clonal response. And then there's also the case where that might already exist, and we've heard from Joyce down at the end, hiding, I guess, that there's all sorts of ways to manipulate the microenvironment to let T cells in. And so, you know, if we have some measures of what it means to be ready to get hit by one of these immunotherapies, then we can start messing with the tumor microenvironment and see which ones do what you need it to do to get it ready for an anti-PD-1.
Or CTLA-4.
Yeah, Harlan, you've got a good PD marker there, but I'm still not sure whether clonality is good or bad.
It's
a PD marker.
Clonality of your T cells is in. I think it's been good, and I mean good for both. There's in two different ways. One is that it's good even with any kind of treatment for cancer, if you just do a prognostic marker. But for prediction for anti-PD-1, it's been pretty strongly predictive of response, including for your guys' drugs too.
any questions out there in the audience? Dr. Bush.
Hi, I'm Andrew Bush from Decline Health, and thank you, Central Jersey. Very, very interesting discussion. Everybody's making very important points, but I think we all agree that we need predictive biomarkers that are on the order, maybe, of binary, right? So they're going to say this person's going to respond and this person is not. That did not turn out to be the case with PD-L1. It certainly enriched for patients who would respond and would not respond. So everyone's talking about combination therapy, and just parenthetically, I don't think combination therapy is the way to go. I do think we should, I mean, we're going to do it, but we need things that, we need to understand how the agents we have that work, and that's why I wanted to get to Dr. Robbins' very interesting data that he just showed that very compelling, where it seems
like if you combine clonality and tumor infiltration, you almost get to a binary predictive biomarker. So my question is to the panel and to Dr. Robbins, that if you add in, we're adding in treatments together all the time, why don't we add in more and more diagnostic biomarkers until we can be really sure that we can say to a patient, this is going to work for you and this is not going to work for you. So in addition to TIL infiltration and T-cell clonality, what if you looked at PD-L1 or looked at some other biomarkers? That's long enough. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably said in an earlier panel today, which is that it's the first panel where it was the payers. And basically, I think the issue there has been that there, for at least up until recently, there was no other option for someone with metastatic melanoma. So you, even if you were, you know, had a small probability that your biomarker, you know, nobody's perfect, right? The biomarker's not going to be perfect. And so, but now that's changed, where there's a lot of options, and hopefully if we can get some good, I mean, we've heard that BMS, and I mean, I shouldn't even say heard that. I mean, we do a lot of work with you guys, and you guys are actively going after adding these biomarkers to truly, figure out who should and shouldn't be getting these drugs. So I think it's changing, but you probably have a broader perspective on these.
No, I guess my point about all of these potential biomarkers right now is they really are either theoretical biomarkers or PD markers. And we really won't know until we have survival data from phase 3 trials with well-established potential biomarkers included, whether or not they're actually going to be useful.
If I may add one comment to this whole thing. When a biomarker, PD-L1 is probably the first example in this space, rises to the level of being a potential selector for patient populations, and we then take the step towards developing companion diagnostics, which have very strict rules how they're being set up, we as a community, thinking about this prospectively, can actually make a big step towards harmonizing our efforts around these. So for PD-L1, we know there's multiple PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies in development. Those that are aiming to select develop their own companion diagnostic, and each one of them has a separate assay. These assays don't always yield the same results, even on the same patient material. So it could be that patients might have to be tested more than once if you want to use more than one agent over the course of the disease. So certainly important for the field would be not only to understand what biomarkers make biologic sense, but then also the way we use them, the way we develop assays for them, and then finally the way we introduce them into the clinic through companion diagnostics could be coordinated. And that coordination is for PD-L1, there's an effort underway now trying to do that, but it isn't a simple task. And, of course, the methods we use are still methods from the last century. If you talk about immunohistochemistry as a measure, there's a lot more that can be done and probably should be done to understand the complexity of the biology. So these are little teasers that I'm giving you right now. They are not always immediate answers, but if we get on a path towards solving these or thinking about them prospectively for the next round of biomarkers beyond PD-L1, there's a lot we can accomplish.
I just want to back up what Nils had said, that much of what we've been talking about in the context of biomarkers so far have been pharmacodynamic biomarkers. We have to be very careful in our field talking about predictive biomarkers for a few reasons. First of all, unlike biomarkers that we're all used to hearing about that are based upon largely oncogenic driver mutations where the drug either works or doesn't work based upon the kind of hardwired presence or absence of that biomarker, these are dynamic inducible biomarkers, largely, although not exclusively, on the tumor, sometimes on immune cells, sometimes both. So this is very, very complex, and the biomarkers that we've spoken about vary according to the stage of disease that the patient is in, They vary according to the particular tumor and the spot within the tumor that's been biopsied. So there's intertumor and intratumor heterogeneity for some of these biomarkers. And most concerning to those of us who are treating patients is that these biomarkers can sometimes act as gating strategies for patients to either receive or not receive therapies that can convey durable disease control. So I agree with Axel that the biomarkers have to be well harmonized and well and carefully developed, but I think we still have a lot of work to do before we decide what to use as a truly predictive biomarker.
Yeah, no, what Jed just said pointed out a lot of subtleties that were completely missed by the panel this morning. But I want to go back to something that that Axel said. Axel and I have had this conversation before. Axel has despaired over the proliferation of disparate PD-L1 assays. I, on the other hand, revel in it. They're very different assays, and one of those assays may work and another one might not. If we had harmonized early on, we might have missed, you know, a study that would actually pick out the one that could be successful.
And the one other comment about these that I think is, Jed touched on it, but probably needs to be highlighted even further, is that because these changes are dynamic, I don't think that the intention should be that the presence or absence of a biomarker such as PD-L1 would allow or preclude a patient from receiving that agent, because even if they truly are negative, if you manage to induce a response in a combination trial, for example, it's likely to go up, adaptive resistance is likely to be present, and the patient is likely to benefit from anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1. And so really, the gating, as I see it from a drug development point of view, not so much yet the practice of medicine, because I don't think we know enough to say how this will impact the practice of medicine, but in terms of drug development, I think the decision is, should this patient get a single agent anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 because they're highly likely to respond, or should they be enrolled in a trial that examines something that is added to that, that has some increased risk of toxicity, but is ethically justified by the profiling of the tumor at start.
Yes, so I concur with that point, and I concur with what you all have said. It's a dynamic system, and it's about understanding biology. The point I made about harmonization comes from a different angle. It's simply the field is going in the direction of producing companion diagnostics, and if you have labels that allow only a patient that is testing positive with a certain assay to receive the drug, you're in a situation in which you have to deal with this problem. That's all I'm saying. Of course, it doesn't address the biology, but it's a very practical issue of the field. We have no choice. We have to deal with it.
Any comments, Johanna, from or Ada, on what we've just been talking about in terms of the biomarker aspect of?
I mean, I would be interested to hear from the other panelists what you think about the immunoscore, immunophenotyping that's being pioneered by a number of groups in France, particularly Jerome Gallon and Friedman, just as a basic scientist, to kind of hear from your perspective whether you think that this has legs or not.
I look at it right now as a drug discovery tool. I mean, I'm looking at those signatures and saying, what else can I target for combinations?
I see it. I think that Harlan mentioned this before, that these are all different ways, I think, that we're looking at the same problem of what's the interaction between the immune system and the tumor within the microenvironment. So I think Jerome is approaching it from a very elegant pathologic point of view to characterize the cell types that are there with exquisite quantification. I think that the reason that those cells are there are probably due to perhaps the inherent immunogenicity of the tumor, which perhaps is driven by the presence or absence of critical neoepitopes, and the clonality, which Harlan's team is able to quantify, is a similar manifestation of baseline immune reactivity. So I think that we are looking at essentially the same problem through different lenses. I think in the future it would be fantastic if we could actually take the same subset of responders and non-responders to a given immunotherapy and see whether all these different approaches yield the same favorable patient populations.
And I also think, going back to what Axel was just saying as well, which is, you know, and the big problem that the Immunoscore group's been having is that is really just technical. I mean, I do think that there's a lot of legs in terms of the biology, and we've seen it in 100 different ways, but, you know, they're doing immunohistochemistry, and then they're trying to have a standardized way of imaging this thing, and having software that can do it automatically, and that becomes an extremely hard thing to do technically. You know, we're kind of developing a competing method where we're doing a molecular assay, just count T cells. I mean, the nice thing about the immune system, what we're learning from the Immunoscore, they started out by measuring, quantifying, you know, 50 different cell types, and now they've found out that, okay, basically just knowing, just looking at T cells in general, the immune system's a system, so having more T cells is basically what the Immunoscore is broken down to at this point. You know, there's some parts on where the T cells are in the tumor, but they've dropped, you know, the T regulatory cells, the CD4, all the other subtypes of cells are no longer part of the Immunoscore because they didn't work practically, but they're still getting the same answer. So the nice thing is that everything seems to be consistent in this picture. And so, you know, the question is, how do we truly make this practical and get it out to make it useful as opposed to something that's sort of in an academic setting?
Any questions?
Chad, I want to take it to a practical issue for how you decide which trial to prioritize for a given patient. So you now have two approved agents, and you have a group of patients that you will do a biomarker test on, and you may or may not know the result at the time that patient comes in for a therapeutic choice. Which combination do you prioritize versus standard of care, Nevo or Pembro at this point? And, you know, how do you advise the industry to think about patient populations because the referral base will now change?
That's a great question. I mean, the world is changing very quickly for all good reasons. And I think within the field of melanoma, you're not going to necessarily get consistent answers. But if a patient comes to us at Memorial now with metastatic melanoma and has not received a checkpoint blocking agent yet, and is relatively able to receive therapy, which has a likelihood of inducing toxicity, manageable toxicity, but still there, then we would offer them the expanded access of CTLA-4 plus PD-1. If someone were, you know, and I don't want to be, ageist here, but if someone were 95 years old and had, you know, critical aortic stenosis, you know, maybe I wouldn't offer them that combination, but rather would offer them PD-1 blockade monotherapy. How you choose between the two approved agents is beyond my pay grade. But I think that, you know, we prioritize based upon what we as an academic team believe is the best possible therapy for a patient based upon known efficacy as well as their comorbidities. Once you get beyond that into the era of no data yet for sort of second and third line therapy, then you actually go back to honestly the preclinical science and say, what makes the most sense to you? What is really mechanistically the next logical step for a patient who has a given disease with a given treatment background? And then you can look the patient straight in the face. And when they say, well, do you think this is going to work for me? You know, and you can embellish upon the I don't know answer by saying, I don't know, but in laboratory models, this particular approach caused X, Y, or Z to happen.
Any other questions? Right here in front, James? Almost in front, right there.
Yeah, I have a question regarding biomarkers and the immune oncology. I was just following discussions in the morning and also right now in the panel, we can see there's a lot of interest scientifically to look at biomarkers that will predict IO responses in the clinic. But we could also imagine that with the current 6 or 8 PD-1 antibodies are being developed in the clinic, that there may be an advantage to have a biomarker, predictive biomarker for one of these, and it could be an advantage more from the payer and the, you know, the the maybe the insurance side, that they would pick a PD-1 marker that comes with a biomarker because it is a more high predictive value to that to actually respond, that the patient respond to that PD-1 that comes with a biomarker. Is there any thoughts here from the panel whether there could be a strategic advantage to link your PD-1 marker with a biomarker, even though it may not be perfect biologically?
It's beyond all of our pay grades. But I just want to make one point about biomarkers for drugs like the various PD-1 blocking agents, and that is they better be very good predictive biomarkers, because if you are going to deny a patient a drug because their probability of a long-term durable survival went from, say, 50% to 30%, that's a big thing you're telling that patient.
So I think this is where the regulatory and reimbursement people come in. And the question is, if you, let's say there is a companion diagnostic for one group's anti-PD-1 therapy and not for the other seven, let's say, are they going to assure that you are only, are they going to require that if you have that biomarker say you should be getting anti-PD-1, that you it's connected to that company's drug? And so far there's no kind of version of that actually is held true by the reimbursement community, and that's been a big problem, right? Like, I think ALK testing is a good example, right, where there was an FDA approved ALK test, and probably nobody here even knows that, right? Because I could in my own lab, I could create an ALK test in a CLIA lab, and it would be reimbursed and also used as a viable companion diagnostic in a month from now. So, you know, there's got to be some change in that system in order for that to become a reality.
And again, one thought is, you know, what happens after that patient receives that drug, right? Again, we're not talking about a mutation. We're talking about a biomarker that may be constitutively expressed but may also be inducible, as has been outlined various times before. So, again, we're talking about chronological and geographical issues in determining biomarker status, in addition to the fact that there is a gray, that there is a scale and not a binary cut off, at least from what we understand right now. So I think we'll always, you know, just looking at this specific biomarker of PD-L1 expression, we're always going to be left with a quagmire.
Any other questions? All right, we just have a few minutes left. So one of the topics we started off on the panel we haven't even touched on, so we only have a few minutes to address, and that is the issue of neoantigens and other ways to more directly stimulate the immune system and bring in that T-cell infiltration, hopefully that can be allowed by appropriate manipulation of the tumor microenvironment. So I'm just curious about the panelists' thoughts about where we're going and where we should be going in terms of approaches, whether they're classical cancer types of vaccines of various sorts, whether it's oncolytic viral therapy, a variety of these approaches that at least offer the possibility of kind of souping up the activity when linked to something such as an anti-PD-1, PD-L1.
Yeah, so I give a thought just to start this. Neoantigens are very exciting. The discovery of neoantigens is very exciting, and it's a very interesting scientific contribution to the field. At the moment, we can use them as biomarkers, as we've just discussed. They'll probably also have a certain element of dynamic, but they can predict eventually, or the load of neoantigens may predict responsiveness. At least that's what the data suggests so far. I have some skepticism towards using neoantigens as vaccines, because we have an extensive experience with vaccines in the field. There's many different ways to deliver antigen to the immune system, and if you only do that, then the question still arises, how do we deal with the suppressive function of the immune system? So then it really is a question of, is a neoantigen a better antigen than a non-neoantigen? And we have tested many of those already. It's hard to tell, and there's a lot more study to be done before you really know the answer.
I'll throw a couple comments in. I don't think anyone is proposing that vaccines of any shape or form be used as monotherapy. I think we've learned that lesson. And I would give the flip side of the argument that Axel just highlighted, which is we have learned a lot from many studies of vaccines that were deemed to be clinical failures, but maybe have been, some of them, biological successes, in that they've been able to induce immune responses as measured in the blood, and in some cases those same cell populations can be found in the tumor. And I would argue that's pretty much all you can ask a vaccine to do. And everything that comes downstream of that event is going to require checkpoint inhibitors and modulations of the tumor microenvironment. So it's not about a single-agent vaccine approach. Now, whether mutations prove to be superior to shared antigens, I think it's too early to say. I think the immunologists would certainly be correct in pointing out that there are a lot of biological reasons why a mutation would be superior, or a collection of mutations would be superior. And we're just going to have to see. The technology is now there to actually, of course, make patient-specific vaccines, and there are indeed companies that are poised to do this. It will be an interesting experiment to see how that pans out, but I would remind you that if you read carefully in some of the literature that has looked at deep sequencing of the cancer genome and transcriptome, that there are also shared antigens that correlate very nicely with immunologic signatures, such as the expression of endogenous retroviruses and other molecules that are aberrantly expressed but not intrinsically mutated. So stay tuned. I think there's a lot more that may happen here. And then the final thing I'll just mention, because you brought up oncolytic viruses, it's intriguing, and wouldn't it be nice if that were the end of the story? And I guess we need to see. There are now studies, for example, Amgen and Genentech are collaborating on a T-VEC anti-PD-L1 trial, which will be interesting to see. My own concern, and it's nothing more than a theoretical concern, is that the host response to these viruses is so focused that the demonstration of a response to shared tumor antigens may be more difficult to elicit, but time will tell.
I think that the open question right now about shared antigens is whether that's going to represent a wall that you can't get beyond for IO therapy. I mean, certainly Jed's data right now, Jed and his colleagues have shown that there is a significant enrichment in melanoma and now non-small cell lung cancer patients that is afforded by looking at the neoantigen load. But it's going to be interesting when you look at that same sort of neoantigen signature in ipilimumab plus nivolumab, mm-hmm. and see whether or not that wall still exists. Mm-hmm. And it may be that other tumors, perhaps colorectal tumors or other tumors, pancreatic, whatever, it may be that neoantigen, the lack of neoantigens is the wall, but it may also be the tumor microenvironment. It may be something special about the macrophage infiltration. So these are just all open questions right now. But if it turns out that neoantigens are limiting for the IO agents that we have on the table right now, then we're going to need to, out of at least desperation, hope, we're going to need to look at tumor vaccines, because we're going to need to look at a way to prime responses to autoantigens, responses that don't exist, because that will mean that the conventional agents that we have on the table right now are just looking at pre-existing immune responses, and they're not able to elicit new immune responses. So we do need to keep studying vaccines. I'm not sure we're quite there yet.
All right, great. Well, appreciate everyone's agreeing to do this in a different time zone and forestalling lunch. And thank you, all seven panelists. Clearly, we proportionalized to the intensity of interest in the space. Next year, there might be 20 people on the panel. So, again, thank you, everyone. Thank you for your attention. And lunch is served.